Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actress Sienna Miller. When Sienna Miller got her first big acting job on the short-lived Fox television show Keen Eddie, she had no grand plans for her career. Surrounded by a bustling crew and a shiny big budget production, she was simply happy to be there. And as a 19-year-old with zero drama school experience, she had no idea about the competitive side of the industry, which instilled in her a naive confidence in auditions that led to early success. Although Keen Eddie was abruptly canceled, Sienna's film career was taking off. Within the span of a few years, she made her mark in films like Layer Cake, Alfie, and Factory Girl. Of course, she learned relatively quickly that success and fame in her profession meant the loss of her cherished private life. And in the eyes of the prying, often aggressive paparazzi, she was perfect tabloid fodder. As she explains it, "When I was at work, I was completely immersed and serious, but I just didn't understand why I couldn't be very serious at work and very frivolous outside of it." Despite her challenges with the media, Sienna's love for her work never wavered. In recent years, she's taken on new, exciting acting challenges. Despite being initially terrified by the immensity of the role, she turns in a heart-wrenching tour de force performance in Jake Scott's new film, American Woman. Sienna joins off camera to talk about the self-torture inherent in the profession, getting bribed with a pony and a rabbit to go to boarding school, and what it was like to spend an hour in the shoes of Tippi Hedren getting pelted with flying birds. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Sienna.
Hi, Sam.
Thank you for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it took me a minute to remember that we had worked together in 2003. When I first found out you were coming in, I was like, wait a minute. I think she was that brand new actress on that
brand spanking new
show, Keen Eddie. What had happened was I got the job to fly over to London and photograph this new show that was going to be huge. American like investigator,
yeah,
who gets an all English team. And we ended up going around to Big Ben, to pubs, and we did this whole shoot for the advertising. And yeah, you were a completely unknown
actress. I mean, it was my first
actress.
Job.
Isn't that wild?
That's wild.
You were really well behaved.
Because I normally remember, was I?
Yes, you were. I think you were very happy to be there at that time.
I think it was probably extremely exciting.
Yeah. What do you remember about?
I must have been 20. You know, I think I was so naive about the entire industry. I didn't really go to drama school, so I wasn't aware of competition. So I would go into rooms and be like, oh, this is an audition. I could absolutely get it without being aware that there was that. Do you know what I mean? That it was not that easy. And I think that kind of naivety or ignorance was really beneficial. I think I was much more confident. And that's just gradually whittled away as I've got older. But I mean, I remember that time. I think it was so exciting. It was a big studio and it was like American and it felt shiny and the sets had all been built. Like it was a big production.
And then when I showed up,
and then
you're like,
you arriving,
wow, this
was
must
just
be
like,
a big
I've
show.
Really arrived because Sam is taking these pictures. But it feels so long ago.
I bet.
I always get sad and sort of nostalgic for that, for the just the sort of the innocence of it all. It was fun. It was a fun time.
But it's also like the challenge of actually getting something feels so good rather than maintaining something, which feels so out of control.
I feel like I still have that challenge. You know, I feel like that, I wonder, I speak to a lot of people who I would really think were at the top of their game. And I think there's something about acting where it's just a constant struggle. People win Oscars and go home and are very depressed because they're like, now what? You know what I mean? Like there's some sort of weird, I think the self-torture is really part of the experience. Yeah. Like it's never enough, but what are you looking for, really?
You know, when that show happened, obviously, it was a network show.
Oh, I blew up. No,
it was on Fox.
It was a fizzle.
No, and it got canceled like,
yeah,
like
boom.
That, right?
Yeah.
Do you remember thinking like...
Didn't really think about it.
You didn't?
I mean, no, I was so wherever the wind blew. And by that point, it was exciting because I got a film and that was...
Right.
You know, I really had no business strategy or sense whatsoever. I mean, I'm just learning about that side of things. It sounds strange, but it's true.
You know, when you think about that, you probably had to sign a 7-year contract.
I did. So I would have been 27, 28.
Now think about your
life
there
for
a minute.
Which felt so old when I signed it. I was like, oh, I'll be ancient now.
But it is such a different path, you know, when you see a TV show that does get famous and people do get locked into one job for 7 or 8 years.
Yeah.
And in a way, you found out rather quickly that you could do film acting and that your career was going to go in a very different direction. So in a way, I think that being canceled was probably like a huge, like, a positive.
Yes, definitely. I'm not the type of person that would be happy 7 years playing the same role.
Can you imagine? I know.
I can't imagine. I'm sure when I'm in my 50s, that will be great.
You'll be
living in one place. And
Keen Eddie 2.
Keen Eddie 2, yeah, she's
the
back.
Return. Not so keen anymore.
Not so keen, yeah. Bitter Eddie.
Old Eddie.
Old Eddie. Yeah, I can't
What was your character's name? I don't even remember.
I was thinking Fiona. Was that
Old mean? Eddie and Bitter Fiona.
Bitter Fiona.
Well, I just saw American Woman.
Yeah.
Which is a tour de force. I mean, you age, what, 15 years throughout the course of the movie?
Maybe a little less, but yeah.
Like, you play a woman who had a daughter very young. Maybe you were 15 or 16. You have this daughter, and so you're a very young mom. But then she has a kid, and you're a grandmother.
A 32-year-old granny.
You're playing a 32-year-old granny. And the course of this film takes you on this emotional journey that's crazy, like, in terms of bad relationships, bad choices, tragedy. Your daughter goes missing, and you end up having to raise your grandson. And it is just, I mean, is this the kind of job you become an actress for in the first place, and then you find out how few roles there are like this?
Yeah, I think it absolutely is. I mean, it's certainly the most fulfilling film I've ever been a part of, and definitely the greatest role that I've been given. Primarily because of the arc, being able to begin as one thing and end as someone else and go on that journey. And I also don't think I've ever done a film where I'm in every single scene, so that was very rare to read these kinds of scripts and get that kind of role.
Well, it occurs to me, like, how rare a film gets financed and made that
where the focus
flips,
is on...
flips the focus to the woman.
Yeah.
And you quickly find out that the roles are not... often demanding enough of your abilities and skill.
Yeah, and it's funny enough, it's something I didn't even notice. I was always so goddamn grateful to be working.
And is that true?
It's so gendered that it really takes a moment for me to sit back and go like, yeah, it's not quite enough. But I think you're so accepting as a woman. It's such a strange thing. And I think I'm really in awe of the generation beneath me who are far more willing to sort of stand up and notice these things. But I was just grateful, which feels like a gendered response. I was so happy to be on those sets doing kind of relatively insignificant things in great movies by great men. But I wanted to do more. And it takes doing something like this to realize, well, you're capable of doing more.
Right.
And it requires, you know, investment and encouragement from really men who are running this town. But a man wrote this script. Like, that's pretty fantastic.
That's a good point. And it makes me wonder, when you got the script, if you start reading this thing. And I'm wondering if it was offered to you or if you had to audition.
I was offered it. I had to meet him.
Jake Scott, who directed it,
yeah. I remember reading it and having an absolutely clear vision. I knew exactly who this woman was, and I knew exactly how to do it. And then I think I was doing press for Live by Night, this gangster movie that I did that Ben Affleck directed, and so it was a kind of crazy time, and I was exhausted and I flustered, and I went to meet Jake at the chateau, and as I was walking in, I like tripped over, which happens every single day of my life. I'm a total klutz, but he saw me like bang into a table and knock someone's drink and be like, sorry, and he was like, Deb, done. That's Deb. She's got it.
Really?
I think by the time I'd reached his table, his mind was made up.
And when you get the job, is there a reaction that you have that sort of You could trace back that you have a similar reaction every time you get a film, which is, oh, now I have to do it.
The getting of the job is the best part of a job.
Then having to do the job.
And then the panic. And then there's, especially with this subject matter, like, do I really want to put myself in the mindset of a mother who has to confront the fact that her daughter is missing? Like, what about that? Like, how's that going to go?
So what is the sort of point in the prep of the panic, and what is sort of your inner voice saying?
It's almost in the same moment of elation of like, wow, this is going to be great. It's, oh, fuck, I don't want to do it. Like, and I honestly, deep down, I kept hoping that this movie would be canceled. I was terrified.
What were you most terrified of?
I just think it felt daunting. I think I was scared of being the lead. I was scared of the kind of enormity of the role, I was scared of having to like go to that place. Did I really want to look at that? Like,
right.
And really, and there's only one way of doing this, which is to feel that feeling, which is the most unimaginable grief you can possibly imagine experiencing.
Right.
And meeting women and men who have lost children. And like, it's a dark psychology, but actually I met this man and I said, I just cannot imagine what that would be like. And he said, you have and you can. And that's exactly what it's like. It's always so close to the surface. I think you have a child.
Yeah.
And you can, you know, you can imagine the loss.
Did you make it personal or did you invent something in your head? And can you, in that situation, not make it personal?
You can't not. I mean, it's my only point of context. And it, but it didn't feel gratuitous.
Because you have a seven-year-old daughter.
I have a nearly,
nearly seven-year-old daughter, so.
Yeah. And you read about these stories. I mean, Madeleine McCann, or, you know, you grow up hearing these horrible stories about missing children.
Right.
So it's not that it's remote. You know, my daughter also, as soon as she was born, she'd like look out of a window and I'd go all the way to the pavement. You know what I mean? Like you just,
right.
There's something about parenting. Maybe it's some sort of precautionary reaction so that you're protecting them in a deep way. But I couldn't help but imagine my own child.
How much do you have to kind of go there into the darkness? You know what I mean? Because for me, I go there for a minute. I'm like, well, I'm not going to look at that.
But it's,
you
it's
have
sitting
to look
with
at
it. And it's,
right.
But it's not gratuitous. It's not, I didn't feel like I was kind of exploiting my relationship with my daughter in any way, except it came from a place of what I suppose like empathy, which I suppose is all acting really. Like, what is that? What is that like to experience that? Like, life is misery and hard for a lot of people, but to like to put yourself into those, you know, it's agony. It's absolute fucking torture.
Yeah, I wonder if you knew going in that what was going to be required of you was to sort of be in a crappy
place. That's why I didn't
want
to do it. I was like, please God, can it just not happen? Like, I didn't want to go, and it kept getting pushed. It's so hard to make a small film. I just wanted to run away from it, but that's sometimes where real creativity kind of can spring from.
I'm sure.
But no, it sounds indulgent because it was a performance. But there's something about the resilience of people that I really think this film celebrates, like in spite of that tragedy, which is about as bad as I can imagine.
Very much so.
People carry on.
And I don't think that it's overindulgent. I think that,
or tourism or something, which I really didn't.
Right,
want it to,
but I think that for an audience to feel something, you have to actually feel it. Like, that's the weird thing about acting. It's not your story. It's not your child. But if you don't authentically feel it, we won't either. I mean, do you sort of come to that in your own profession that like it has to be honest to you?
I mean, it has to be, and you can get away with stuff and it just feels dreadful. You know what I mean? I just don't want to fake it anymore. There's no point doing it. But there are times when you occasionally, you know, doing a play or something and you're just not on and you kind of phone it in and you still get a good reaction and then you're like, you know, like, ooh. But actually, I am so hard on myself that unless it comes from a real place, I mean, I just, there's no point. It doesn't feel good.
What is the inner dialogue like when you're watching your own performance? Are you sort of judging as you go, or
in the moment on a set? I will not give up until, and I feel like I know when I've got something. Of course I don't, but I can be pretty torturous about getting it right, and it's just it does come from a kind of anxious place, but I think sometimes I need to beat myself up to get to the place where I need to get to for it to be authentic.
So in other words, you have to be sort of hard on yourself.
Yeah,
to do
just
your best
really
work.
And I sometimes wish that I could just switch off that whatever is. I can see myself sometimes, and there are moments where I can transcend that and I can't see myself, and that's when I know that I've got to a good place.
Right.
But there is an inner critic that's very, very noisy sometimes.
Really?
And I really have to be like, to turn down the noise.
Whose voice is it?
Mine.
Is it yours? It's funny because, I mean, all our inner critics are our own voice, but I definitely can trace the roots of my own inner critic.
Oh, yeah? Who's yours?
Some actual close friends that I grew up with that were, you know, both great friends, but also
critics.
They pushed me and they were critical.
Yeah. Right.
And I think, you know, the roots of our own, because we don't, no kid starts with a self-critical voice.
I know.
That's the sad part.
You just watch them get whittled down. Yeah. No, it's, yeah. It's
they come
not
out
easy
pretty
to
much
be
perfect.
A human. I know. I know. They fuck you up, your mom and dad. Good
they
old
really
Larkin.
Do. Well, you mentioned confidence earlier, and I was wondering if any of the process for you, especially with a film like this, if there's some aspect of kind of having to prove yourself, either to yourself or to, because I do feel like you've been at times throughout your career underestimated.
I
think you're a really good
actor,
by
the
way. I think you're really good. And I think that you have, like, that has not always been the focus of your career. And so I'm curious coming in there if your confidence before this film was knocked down a little bit, or if you felt like, you know, I think we all in our 30s start to question everything we thought we knew in our 20s.
Yeah, well, you start thinking. I don't think I was doing too much thinking in my 20s. I was just existing, which was kind of amazing.
Yeah.
Liberating.
Well, it certainly is less exhausting if you're not.
But it's so tiring. Actually, ultimately, I mean, I'm, yeah. No, I think that tends to be the narrative, which I find frustrating, is that I'm somebody underestimated.
Oh, do you hear that a lot?
Yeah, I do.
Well, I'll strike that from the record then.
No. You can comment on it. I mean, it's sort of interesting. I think there was a perception of me that was really created, and I think you're stuck in a sort of Ouroboros of like a negative spiral that sells newspapers, and that bad reaction galvanizes bad behavior, and you're stuck in a very destructive cycle. And I definitely experienced my life was just absolutely not my own. It was sometimes very surreal to look in and see how unmanageable everything became. It was very extreme.
Right.
Just in terms of tabloid focus and attention. And it was a really toxic spiral to be caught up in.
And I think that when...
And it just affects perception. It just does.
Sure.
It's impossible not to.
And I think that when you do a film, all that stuff sort of comes back up, because now there you are again, and you're in the public eye, and so this is the next iteration of what your career is. So I guess what I was wondering going into this film is, it seems like this film was an opportunity that was pretty huge.
Mm-hmm.
Probably like Factory Girl was.
Yeah, but also...
Where
but,
it's like you can identify moments where, oh, this... You know what I mean?
Yeah, so but that didn't change. You know what I mean? Then there was still a like, oh, wow, she's good in that film. But like, it's just that there's so much chatter. It's more fun, I guess. More salacious. And like, I don't know. I don't know when creative women were supposed to be extremely well behaved. I mean, it's sort of the two seem to go hand in hand. I should be able to be a kind of reckless 20-year-old and be able to be talented. But somehow you can't be both things.
Well, I hope that's changing.
It's gendered, yes. I think it is. Except I'm not reckless anymore. I'm too tired all the time.
Well,
yeah, I wonder how long you can be underestimated for, but it is a word that I think that just follows me.
Yeah.
And I personally don't feel like I have an awful lot more to prove. I mean, I feel like I'm quite content and secure in knowing that I have ability and I know what I can do and what I can't do. It would be nice if that sort of died down.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to ask you about your mom a little bit, because I didn't know that she sort of had a similar path to you in terms of how she started. Like, didn't she run a drama school?
She set up the Lee Strasberg School in London and ran it for a year.
And
was kind of in that world, but she wasn't really. She was also a yoga Pilates Alexander Technique teacher. She set up the first exercise-based school in London in the 70s. Called Grannies.
Really?
Grannies Beautiful Bodies. And she taught like Albert Finney and Ava Gardner. And
oh, like the Alexander Technique.
Yeah, exactly.
Did your mom recognize that you were a creative girl that liked to perform? Like, did she sort of see it and point it out to you? Or did you come to her and say, this is what I want to do?
It's kind of a chicken and an egg thing. And it's something that I've spent a lot of time thinking. I mean, either I just was that child, but I think that she really saw me as that kind of person and really encouraged it in some way. She, you know, I think she'd probably in the depths of her soul had wanted to act and never did it.
Oh, really?
So either she was kind of vicariously living through me, but it didn't make sense in the end, or she just recognized that I was performative, which I think I was.
How old do you think you were when you discovered you loved it?
I mean, I think from the age of 3, I said I wanted to be an actor, but how can
really?
A 3-year-old know that without their mother saying, you're going to be an actor? I honestly don't know. I mean, either way it worked out, it is the right thing for me to be doing, I think. I can't imagine anything else because I never did. But she was definitely encouraging. We'd go to the theater all the time. She went into labor with me during a ballet during the Nutcracker Suite in New York.
Really?
And like wrapped her mink coat around her. Waters had broken in the theater, and she stayed for the whole show. So I was almost born in a
You're joking.
Bloody theater.
Wait a minute. She's literally.
But she's also prone to hyperbole. She might be. I mean, I wonder whether in her mind her waters broke and she wrapped her mink coat around and finished the show. I mean,
the dance of the sugar plum fairy is going
on. But she stayed. And the stoic sort of. I don't know. But yes, she definitely went to labor in the theater.
I'm so curious about your upbringing because you were born in New York. Your family moved to London when you were really young,
yeah.
Right? And then your parents split up when you were still pretty young.
Yeah, five-ish, yes.
Five-ish. And you had an older sister?
Yes.
Do you remember that time well enough, your feelings around it, or were you too young to really clock what was going on?
I mean, it happened very quickly. My only memory of my two parents together, which is really interesting, is me saying, will you ever get divorced? And them saying no. Like, that's the only, I don't remember the two of them in bed. I mean, that's probably a real insight into my mind. But no, I remember we moved and suddenly it was me and my mum and my sister in another house. And I remember my sixth year being very sad, but I don't remember. It was hard to connect the dots.
Yeah.
I remember being very upset on my sixth birthday because I wasn't a baby anymore. But of course, that's much more indicative of the shifts going on in a family life. But all of that stuff, it just informs who you are as a person. You're either somebody resilient or you drown. And those experiences kind of made me pretty tough, I think. It was also not dreadful. I had loving parents.
Yeah, you know, I wonder about that. It's funny how many people come in here that either came from divorce or have gone through divorce or have had some sort of turmoil because...
That's why you become an actor. You know, you're either the people who come from a perfect family with a mother and father who are madly in love that they idolize, they can never replicate that. Or people who come from divorce then have, you know what I mean? Like either
way. Are you saying it's neutral?
Listen, we're all pretty lucky. We've got to be in the top 3% of fortunate people on the planet. But I mean, life is... no matter what happens, life is problem solving and life is complicated and each person is on their own trajectory. And no matter how idyllic it may seem, I'm sure they have pain and existential crisis and all those things that just come with being a human being.
Sure. Were you shipped back and forth between your parents a lot or did you stay mostly with your mom?
You know, I live primarily with my mom. I think like Wednesdays I would go to dad, I think. But I went to boarding school from 8, so.
Tell me about that because
yeah,
I was a kid who if I went off for a week, I'd be homesick and
oh,
you know.
Oh my goodness.
And obviously that happens to your family and then you go off to boarding school and you're living at school. Like, were you a kid that got homesick and?
I don't know, apparently I really wanted to go. On paper it seemed idyllic. It was in this kind of manor house. It was called the Manor. It was in the countryside. You could take a pony and a rabbit. So
did
there were
take
like 50
a
little
pony and a rabbit?
I took a rabbit and I took a pony. I got a pony to soften the blow of just utter abandonment.
You have to go to boarding school.
But there's a
but
pony.
We'll give you a pony.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what. I think it's very English. I think my parents, we weren't like a wealthy family. We weren't a grand family. We're not like aristocracy. But I think it was sort of aspirational to be like, there was something kind of elitist about going to a boarding school, and that's what posh people did. And I think my mother probably, I don't know, so it was kind of done somehow, but not normally for girls at that age. But the first...
Yeah, it's very young.
I mean, it's like military. I remember the first night being dropped off at the school and waving goodbye and being sent inside, and suddenly you're in a room with 10 iron single beds, and they all had these kind of thick tweed woolen blankets and lights out at 7 and up at 6:30 and beds made and breakfast in a line. I mean,
was it Madeline?
And uniform. Madeline's much better. You know what? It looked, if I look back at pictures, I'm like, God, how amazing. But I remember being heartbroken. I remember writing letters. You couldn't call because this was like the dark ages.
Yeah.
I'm really old. But writing letters and like trying to cry on the ink so that it would splatter so that they'd see that I was sad. I mean, really tragic. And the first 3 months I was a misery and being, oh my God, sent on the train back to school and like seeing Mum disappear. It was really torture. And then I was like, bye.
Do you think it made
and
you grow
up faster?
And
she was like, kiss me, bye. I would like, would go in. I just decided, yeah. Did it make me grow up faster? I think it probably made me and destroyed me in equal measure. Not destroyed, like, irrevocably, but it created a real strength and a real vulnerability, which is probably very useful.
Yeah.
You know, I'm tough. I can withstand anything, I think. But I'm also very fragile.
What was your coping mechanism when you were at your most despondent? Like, what's the picture of your mind?
I didn't really know how to have one. I just think there wasn't a choice. You either sink or swim. And I think kids who went to boarding school at that age, like, there are issues of abandonment. Like, there just is. Like, it's very jarring. But if you manage to come out the other side, I feel like I can really manage most things. But my coping mechanism, I don't know. I probably stroke my rabbit. It sounds like a horrible euphemism. Probably that too. Anyway, no. stroke my bunny.
Boarding school. You got to do it quietly.
You just got to do whatever gets you through the night. I also bred my rabbit. I got in real trouble because the rabbits were not allowed to be. You can't mate your rabbit with another rabbit. But I sort of just discovered where babies came from, I think. And I got my rabbit, who was very pretty, Daisy, and found the most handsome male rabbit. Got that one, took it in the traveling hutch, ran behind the back of the bike shed. It's obviously really insightful into my perverted little mind.
You did.
And 30 seconds later, the deed was done. I got caught. I was shamed. I remember there was the woman that ran the school was Lady Tryon. She was a very austere, very posh woman who'd be wheeled in on a Friday for
assembly. Did she have a cane?
Almost. In my mind, she was like Miss Trunchbull. She was probably quite innocuous, but... And we'd have to stand up in lines and they'd say, you know, five gold stars, one black mark. There was something called a black star, which was five black marks, which was unheard of. And they went, Sienna Miller, like five gold stars and one black star. And I had to stand out in the line. And she went, what for? And I had to say, for mating my rabbit with Alice. And she said, that is disgusting. I was really shamed.
God.
I was so embarrassed. But then one day I came down to the hutch and there were five baby bunnies. And Irene Bain, who was our Latin teacher, came up to me and she went, it was worth it, in my ear. And it was the most joyous moment of my life. I mean, like five beautiful babies, one of which turned out to be a prize rabbit. I bred this prize rabbit that was all white with black eye makeup and blue eyes. It was like a superstar, Cleopatra, yeah.
So, what a complicated childhood.
Yeah.
You're being told that it's disgusting.
It's disgusting that
you're stroking your rabbit.
Yeah, touching the bunny. And then it was sort of fun. I think it was just very eccentric.
Did you go through all the way through in school?
You know, that school burnt down.
You burned it down, didn't you?
I did not burn it down. By that point, I sort of loved it. It was mad and rambling and like, it was really, it became fine.
Wow.
Once I managed to sort of fill the void of the abandonment or whatever.
Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Let's take a little break from the conversation so I can tell you about this week's sponsors, Boosted. If you listen to this podcast a lot, you know I'm an advocate for all fun forms of transportation. That includes motorcycles, bicycles, skateboards, hoverboards, one-wheel boards, surfboards, paddleboards, and now Boosted boards. A couple weeks ago, a box arrived at the office, and Boosted had sent me two boards, their mini and their longboard. And I immediately plugged them in and charged them, and I've been a fan ever since. And I zip around Santa Monica on these things, and it's the most fun way to get to lunch that we found at Off Camera. Now, if you've never seen a Boosted board, it's the coolest skateboard in the world. It's got an electric motor, and it can go really fast, although there's different modes, so if really fast scares you, it can also go relatively fast, or just fast enough to make you feel cool. But here's the other thing. Instead of sitting in traffic, searching for parking, or smelling your seatmate's sandwich on the bus, imagine riding the streets, wind in your hair, on your own Boosted electric vehicle. Boosted's vehicle-grade electric skateboards and scooters are the modern solution to your transportation woes. With a 22-mile range and max speeds of 24 miles per hour, Boosted is perfect for both running to the store and traveling across town. And designed to provide a luxurious experience, it's no wonder that Boosted was one of Time magazine's best inventions of 2018. With five options to pick from, including their new scooter, the Boosted Rev, there's a personal electric vehicle that's tailor-made for you. Starting at $61 a month with financing, there's no better time to change how you move than now. So right now, Boosted is offering our listeners $75 off the purchase of an electric vehicle when you use the code CAMERA at checkout. As an added bonus to this, I'm so into this company and into the boards, and I have such fun riding them that I want to hear from you guys if you get one. So go on their website, get a Boosted board or a scooter, and send me an email. Tell me about your experience. And also, if you want to come down to Santa Monica and ride Boosted boards together, send me an email, and what I'll do is I'll pick somebody and I'll buy you lunch and we'll go terrorize the neighborhood on our Boosted boards. So what are you waiting for? Go to boostedboards.com and use the code CAMERA at checkout to get $75 off your vehicle. That's boostedboard.com, promo code CAMERA at checkout for $75 off. Now back to the show.
When you were 17, were you on a path like, I'm serious, I know what I'm going to be an actor? And
I wanted to be an actor. I don't know how serious I was.
Right.
I mean, I definitely wanted to be an actor, and I was full of life and energy, but I couldn't sit still.
So what did you do?
At 17, what did I do? Oh, I went traveling.
You did?
I moved to New York the day after I turned 18. So that was that summer. I finished school when I was 17 in the summer, and then I think I worked in London. I, like, wrapped boxes for a jewelry company and waitressed and, you know, made some money, and then moved to New York and went to Lee Strasberg, that school in New York, for 3 months, and traveled around Central America. Fell in love with a yoga teacher in Guatemala, lived there for a while in a place called Las Piramides, this, like, quite out there meditation place.
Wow, you really sort of lived a loose bohemian,
quite
like,
nomadic
existence.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah.
And when you went to drama school in New York, did you, like, was that something where you're like, oh, these are my people? And
it was more just I wanted life. I was ready. I mean, I was very misunderstood at school.
How so?
I think I was smarter than they gave me credit for, so I used to be, like, get dreadful grades. Fucking underestimated. This thing is haunting me, because I was naughty, and I think I was charming. I wasn't, like, cruel, but I was, you know, I was a character. I was a bit of a clown. So I couldn't possibly be clever and that, you know what I mean? In quite a rigid all-girls boarding school. So I used to do badly in school exams, and I used to do things like swap papers with the top of the class. And then get A's from mine and C's. You know what I mean? Like, it was underestimation. It's so sad. And now they always want me to come back and cut ribbons and open up their fucking theaters. And I'm like, no.
Is that true?
I mean, I should really, but yeah.
You have a little chip on your shoulder about that.
Yeah, a little bit chippy, but that can be useful.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I think about that all the time. Like, you remember these moments or people in your life where you're like, I'll show you.
Yeah, grit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, do you remember somebody's face in particular of, like...
I remember the physics teacher saying, you're a lovely girl, Sienna, you're just not very bright. But I was like, why am I looking at why light bends through a prism? Of course, now, understanding what physics is...
She said you're a lovely girl, but you're just not very bright.
Yeah, because I was like, what? I just wanted to be living my life. I couldn't understand why I was wasting my time trying to figure out algebra. And it wasn't taught to me in a way that made it interesting. I was just taught the wrong way. She was really nice. She just underestimated me.
I don't know why this word follows you around.
Oh, for God's sake. No, that, I mean, but I didn't feel, I just felt frustrated. You know, I went to this school and I had the best time, and the school is amazing. I don't want to shit on it because I made the best friends of my life, and we had an incredible time. But it was an all girls posh boarding school that I had a kind of semi scholarship to.
Almost like it provided you something to rebel against a little bit, right?
Yeah, boarding school is just exactly, it's just a melting pot for rebellion.
Yeah.
But they used to deliver the Time, the Telegraph and the Daily Mail were the two newspapers that we got delivered to our common room. So you're just a Tory, that's what you are. You're a conservative and you're posh and you have good manners and you smoke down the back of the bike shed and you kiss the gardener and you're sort of, it's Centrinians basically, but it's this very, very English place. And then I left school, I was like, wait a second, Labour and Marxism and socialism. And there's this whole aspect to my life that I had really not discovered. So I honestly felt that my education began once I left, even though I got a lot from it.
Do you remember a time when you did get serious?
Yeah, I mean, my first play, I wanted to be respected always. That was always, I mean, doesn't everyone want that? I think I wanted that, and it felt like I had to try and get it. I mean, that's never come that easily. It's easy to misunderstand someone. I think doing my first play, I was terrified, and every time I was working, I was very, very serious. Factory Girl, I think I was 23, and I completely immersed myself in that. So the work was always serious, but I just didn't understand why I couldn't be very serious at work and very frivolous outside of it.
And you should be able to be.
I should have, but I just didn't have the right. I needed to be looked after a little bit.
I want to talk about three films that you did around the time of Factory Girl. I don't know the exact chronology, but Factory Girl, The Girl, and Interview.
The Girl. Lots of, yeah.
Which,
and now
which,
I'm doing woman things.
That's right. You've graduated to a woman. No, but there's three films.
Factory Girl, The Girl, and Interview, did you
say? Interview, yeah. Where you play actresses, really. You play performers.
Oh, yes.
And all three are amazing performances. In Factory Girl, you play Edie Sedgwick.
Yeah.
And we get to see the birth of that scene of Andy Warhol in the factory and Bob Dylan. And,
yeah.
And then in The Girl, you played Tippi Hedren.
Yes.
During the time where she films The Birds with Alfred Hitchcock.
And is underestimated.
And
as
is
was
underestimated.
Edie, as was the character in Interview.
In Interview, she was wildly underestimated.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to ask about that was those films came out around the time when there was so much turmoil in your life as well, and you have to depict an actress who, in the case of The Interview, the very first scene, you're being followed by paparazzi. You know what I mean? And I feel like you took that film on at a time where all that stuff had already happened.
Yeah.
It must have been like crazily confusing and full of turmoil and weirdness and life meets art and all that.
It was really surreal, but to be honest, I agreed to do Interview before I even read the script because Steve Buscemi had called me and said, I want to do a film with you. And I was
really?
Like, done. He's like, you should read it. I was like, no, I'm doing it. Like, I've loved him. So it
note to self.
Yeah. Yeah, probably read the script. Although it turned out fine.
No,
I'm
it's
so
a great
film.
I just, yeah. I was just watching it the other night and I was like, you
it's
know, wow,
cool.
Talk about throwing gasoline on the fire.
I mean, it didn't really, it never really, I don't know, it felt like the right thing to do. There wasn't much reflection. I was very kind of knee-jerk. I think nowadays I would be more conscious of the effect of things, but I just wanted to experience or have experiences and work with somebody who I loved growing up watching.
I think that's
Mr.
so...
Mr. Pink, for God's sake.
Exactly. I think that's
but
actually...
But there wasn't a lot of thought. I was just like, yes, yes, yeah. I mean, I was just the most kind of... I was pathologically optimistic. I still have optimism, even though I seem a bit morose today, but...
And did you love the work as much even after going through some of the you know, stuff that went along with the work that was obviously really...
I never stopped loving the work. I did get really exhausted and beaten down by the notoriety or the mess and the noise.
Yeah.
And you know, it was really intense. That was a time when there was no social media. There was not that I engage with that now either, but there was no means of really protecting yourself.
No.
And so it was aggressive. It makes you lose your mind. I mean, it's insane harassment. It really, really is.
Yeah. Well, talk a little bit about the Tippi Hedren situation in The Girl, because it is a sinister film. Toby Jones plays Alfred Hitchcock, and you really get the sense that in that era of filmmaking, directors would take ownership of their actresses. And there was such a wooing and a like, that whole film is about that.
Yeah.
But, you know, it makes me wonder, as you're going through playing this completely underestimated actress and what she had to go through in the 50s, I'm sure there had to have been some thoughts of, you know, why did no one stand up for her at the time, or what still hasn't changed?
What was really devastating, aside from the abuse, and having met Tippi and spent time with her, she is so
steely. Oh, did you really?
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. She's so strong. I think the reason that he tortured her was because she just has this kind of steeliness. She's just not going to capitulate. I think Grace Kelly probably sat on his knee and, you know, they just knew how to play the game where it was charming and therefore he'd be fine. There was nothing to kind of, there was no pushback. But Tippi was just, she was a mother. She was a woman and she just wouldn't play those games and it drove him nuts. But I think the worst part about that, aside from the, you know, torture of making the films, was that he kept her under contract for 10 years and Bergman wanted to work with her, Truffaut. She got off with all these films and he wouldn't release her to do them
that.
And he wouldn't use her. So he watched her get old, basically, at a time
right.
when looks were everything. That's the most vicious thing, I think.
Yeah.
It's so vindictive and torture. But directors can be controlling types of people. There's something there is something in that. I just think they're allowed to be that way. And I think that really men are very, probably very intimidated by the power of women and have therefore tried to squash it for years.
You know, the infamous scene in that movie is recreating the scene where she gets attacked by all the birds.
That was fun.
And there's a line in it, which is, you know, we told her it was going to be one day of shooting and fake birds, and she's been here 5 days, and we've been throwing real birds at her, and they've been pecking out her eye and shitting on her, and I couldn't help watching that going, this is really realistic. I think...
They're throwing real birds at
me. Yes.
They were. For an hour.
Okay, well...
I was like, I can do 1 hour if Tippi did 5 days.
But...
Unpleasant experience.
I imagine. I
mean... Also, the smell is the thing I remember most. The ammonia... And it's just the sound of a flapping wing in your face is not particularly pleasurable. I also had to have maggots and worms in my pocket to attract them. And I
really?
Was pregnant at the time, and the whole thing was just like, bleh. I mean, it was just like, God. I was newly pregnant. I don't think anyone knew. That was not an experience I'm desperate to recreate.
No, I would think when you're in the middle of that, yeah. I guess it is method acting.
Well, there's no way around it. You don't have to do much thinking. It's all being thrown at you.
Right.
Just
literally.
React. Yeah.
Talk a little bit more about that idea that, you know, the idea of being on a film set and having to be, look, you said at the beginning, you're so grateful to work. You didn't realize, you know, that it could be any other way. And I think there is some of that in acting where actors are made to feel so grateful that they have the job that you're sort of going to do anything and be a team player. And I think that controlling aspect can be really tough in a collaborative form. And I wondered about that on Factory Girl, because there's a pretty serious sex scene. There's a lot of nudity in the film. Some of it doesn't seem
pretty gratuitous.
I don't think you need to answer the phone totally in the nude on the edge of the bed.
I agree, but I was happy to be there.
Sure. No, but I guess, and I bring this up because I just had Olivia Wilde on, and she talked about directing her first film and directing a sex scene, and she got to kind of right a lot of the wrongs that were done to her. And she was able to make it a truly closed set. She was able to do it in a way that was respectful and was for the story and not for two, you know, not serving two masters, story
not
and gratuitous.
Not selling a movie through this, exploitation of young, innocent people.
Yeah, and I wondered about the stuff you had to put up with that now you look back through a different filter.
There was really no reason for those scenes. And I went along with it. I was just...
Well,
As you do, but of course, looking back, it completely doesn't serve a story. And then I remember in the marketing of the film, there was this rumor that started to come out that the love scene was real, that we actually had sex.
Oh, there was?
Which is absurd if you've ever been on a set. But no, I think that was a way of, I think the tagline on the film was like sexy, uncut. It was just like, it just became this thing. And actually what it was this like some intense performances. And I'd worked for a year to try to capture this woman. I mean, it was really a serious piece of work. And it was just marketed in this way that was just completely disrespectful looking back.
You know,
it was supposed to be a closed set, but it wasn't. But I think the things that you sort of tolerate, of course, looking back, I'm like, fuck, did I feel uncomfortable? Absolutely. But there's a crew of 200 people that are also around who are allowing that. So it's a messy situation to find yourself in.
You know, what's interesting to me about that is that you're amazing in that film. And I will say that when the sex scene comes along, it feels like a different film.
Like, why?
It's lit differently. It doesn't look period.
Yeah.
And it wasn't Edie, and it took me out of it, which is exactly sort of the problem with
a lot of
that behavior. Is like, well, that was stuck in the movie for a cross purpose from the story.
Yeah.
And it made me wonder, because I know you did great work in that film, but does how it does critically or how it does at the box office, does that change your feeling about it in the end? Or can you walk away from something saying, well, I know I did my best and then it's not mine?
Yeah, there are actors who are really focused on box office and they're probably the most successful ones. I have never really paid too much attention to numbers. It had never really featured because I don't think I'd ever really had a huge box office kind of success. But I remember the weekend that American Sniper came out and it exceeded everyone's expectation. And I remember how exciting that felt, that people were really going to see this film. So there was this weekend where the numbers were coming in and I was on group emails with Warner Brothers and it was like, come on, you know, these, it was so exciting. And I was like, oh, right, that's what that is. Right. Maybe trying to do movies that are successful. But for me, it was maybe selfishly, it was about the experience. And once I was done with it, I let it go and I never really read reviews. I didn't really know what Rotten Tomatoes was.
I like Rotten Tomatoes.
Rotten Tomatoes.
Much better. It rhymes, Rotten Tomatoes.
Rotten Tomatoes, potato, potato. I never really paid too much attention to it. I didn't really read reviews. I just didn't. I was not really aware of the business side of things. It was much more about my experience.
It's interesting.
It's weird. It's naive. There's a
But it's probably the way you were able to enjoy your career more.
Yeah.
You know, because I think that that can spoil your enthusiasm for something if it has to have a public acceptance or a critical acceptance or if some portion of the smart population has to like it for you to feel validated. Then you're always at the mercy of someone else's opinion.
Yeah. I think I could also tell from people's reactions what it was, you know, how it was received. Factory Girl became like a cult thing. It's still the one thing that people bring up.
Is that true?
Yeah. People are like, I love you in Factory Girl. I was like, it was like 80 years ago, but thank you.
It wasn't as long ago as no, King Eddie.
I know.
Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Let's take a break from the conversation so I can tell you about one of this week's sponsors, Shady Rays. Shady Rays is an independent sunglass company, so they're not some big corporation that overcharges for shades. Everyone knows sunglasses are way overpriced, but Shady Rays is out to do it differently and give people a lot more bang for the buck. They sent me a few pairs, and I have to say I love them. They're polarized, they look great, they're lightweight, and they really hold up like the really expensive brands of sunglasses. But the crazy thing about Shady Rays is the warranty. Their goal is to have the best warranty in all of eyewear. You won't find anything stronger. They include free replacements if the shades are lost or broken for any reason. It doesn't matter what happens. You can drop them in the ocean, or step on them, or run over them with your scooter. They'll replace it. It doesn't matter what happens. You can get an entirely free pair. You'll just pay a small shipping and handling fee for each replacement, and bam, you're back in business. Plus, the quality of every pair is guaranteed for life. That's entirely free coverage for life for the craftsmanship of each pair. And even with that strong of a warranty, they still manage to make quality that I can tell you, holding in my hand, seems just as good as any expensive pair that I have ever worn. The lenses are perfectly clear and most Shady Rays are only $45. Also, Shady Rays is a good company because they provide 10 meals to fight hunger in America with every order placed, and they have provided over 4 million meals to date. That's pretty amazing. They stand behind their product, and they told our team that if anyone has a problem, they throw a profit out the window and they do what it takes to get it right. And best of all, they have free returns and exchanges. You either love the shades or Shady Rays will pay to ship them back. That's it. So here's what they're doing. Exclusively for our listeners, they gave us the best deal they have to offer. You can use the code CAMERA for 50% off two or more pairs. That's buy one, get one free. Basically, you get two pair of sunglasses for $45. And if you're like me, you not only lose sunglasses all the time, but you leave them at home or you leave a pair in the car. So having two pairs is a great way to avoid that problem. This is the best deal that Shady Rays offers. It's exclusively for us. To get this offer, go to ShadyRays.com. You can see all their newest and best shades and use the code CAMERA for 50% off. Now back to the show.
I want to ask you about an interview in the sense of playing someone who is, not only she has your same profession, but she's living in a loft in New York.
Yeah.
But I imagine it would be harder to delineate and make believable a character that
what, like
on the
interview.
Surface, yeah, like interview. And I wondered how much you used that was you and real versus how much you had to create.
I mean, it's a total character. I think everything I've ever done, I can't really see myself in. And I mean, I'm never in my own voice. Very rarely do I act in an English accent, which I should really do more of, because it makes me uncomfortable to feel anything like myself. So that was,
Is that true?
I mean, I remember interview feeling like a send-up, and I remember feeling like it was a fuck you. And like walking into a restaurant with sunglasses on, like it just made me laugh. Like I insisted on that. I suppose she was what people assumed I was.
Right, I mean, almost like you played on that, right?
And she has the last laugh, yeah.
Yeah.
She kind of wins that battle. But it felt like it felt funny to me. It did feel funny to me. And I don't think I've ever been myself in anything.
I think I bring it up because when acting is good, it's almost misunderstood to be easy, I guess.
Yeah. People like to see the work sometimes, but that's one style of acting which can be amazing.
Right. People want to see
But I want to
see Daniel Day-Lewis writing with his foot.
Dragging himself to the loo. On his hands.
Exactly.
Yeah.
People don't want to see you just walking into a restaurant with sunglasses and they're like, oh, that's she does that every day.
Yeah, it was fun though. That was a seriously fun character to play.
I bet.
Just shameless. A shameless celebrity. But it never sat comfortably with me, that level of fame. It didn't suit me at all. I didn't respond well to it. I just reacted.
How do you mean?
I think there's a way of probably accepting that that's a part of your life and allowing it and to some degree playing a game and smiling and not being, it made me feel so, it was so predatory. And I felt so taken from that I reacted. So it felt like a real battle between me and them for years and years and years.
The paparazzi.
Yeah, it was total warfare every day.
Do you remember the
warfare,
first
that's
time?
That's dramatic, but I am
happened.
An actor. The first time it happened, yes. Yeah. I was shooting Alfie, which was I'd done Layer Cake and Alfie. And I think I wrapped one and got back to my flat the next day. And as I came out, there were 15 photographers and that was it. Like one day to the next.
So
but before
overnight,
I'd ever had a film
your life
out,
changed.
Yeah.
Literally overnight.
Literally overnight. It was weird. It was just a very weird experience. And these are like English paparazzi. It's not, nowadays they're a little bit more respectful. But there was no kind of parameter. There was no, I mean, they would really try to get a reaction and I couldn't not give it. I was just too mouthy and gobby. And
you think so?
I was like, whoa! I refuse to conform and live my life. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. I bring this up because you're now playing, ironically, you're playing the wife of Roger Ailes in this show, The Loudest Voice, which is coming out on Showtime. And you're basically telling the story of the man who you sued, like the corporation.
Countless times. Yeah, News Corp many times.
Yes. And now you're in this thing.
Yeah.
Is there a certain level of vindication to doing that story?
No, that's not what I think, honestly, and this is true, to look at the inception of Fox News and like how that became what
it's
it came.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, to be in that world for 5 months is fascinating.
Right.
But yes, it did make me laugh that one of my arch nemeses was a character in it.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's that world like? I sued, I don't know, I can't even count the number of times I must have sued News Corp.
Well, you know, I'm amazed that it didn't dim your enthusiasm for this business enough to make you walk away from it.
I mean, there were moments. I think I moved from London probably because the association was so negative for so long. I think that's probably why I live in New York, to be honest.
Yeah.
But then that would have been defeatist, which is just not part of my character. There was no
really
way.
Not.
In fact, if anything, it galvanized me to work harder and do more. But there was definitely a moment in time where I was so sick of it. I was intensely paranoid and really anxious and just like fed up. It was just exhausting being me at that moment.
I'm sorry you had to go through that.
It's okay.
I think there's
something. You know what? It makes you stronger, but it was looking back now, it was incredibly intense.
Yeah.
You'd think I'd be cynical and I'm not at all.
That's a tribute to you.
Quite the opposite. I mean, there's so much, everything you say about human nature is trite, but there's so much beauty in the world and I definitely have always been focused on that. I do think that women really suffered in terms of that kind of behavior. I think it was very focused on women. And I think to a certain degree, the media has a lot of growing up to do.
Yeah.
But no, there are some bad people. The majority of people have empathy and souls. And then there's Rupert Murdoch. You know what, nowadays it happens. Unfortunately, I live in New York, which can be quite bad for that, but it's and there every morning I will walk my kid to school, and every morning they know that I'm going to walk my kid to school. So at 8:15, pretty much every morning, there's a photo of me. You know, they'll block out her
face. Is that true? Even
to
this day?
Yeah, but they're hiding behind a lamppost or a dustbin on the other side of the street. I mean, I look like a hag because there is no way I'm going to make up my face or put on an outfit 8 in the fucking morning to go on a school run. But it's not aggressive. So you know what? It irritates the fuck out of me, but I can somewhat ignore it. But when I was in my 20s, they would block my front door so that I couldn't get my key in. It was like, it was this close.
Is that true?
Yeah. I would try to get into my door and they'd block my door so I'd be like that trying to get the key. I mean, you can look up photos. It was horrible.
And would you recognize individual people?
Oh, God,
like,
yeah.
you knew them?
Oh, completely. It's very predatory. It's very male. It's very much a hunt. It's very strange. It's like a pack mentality. And looking at men behaving that way and the victim being like a young woman.
Right.
And the somewhat kind of erotic aspect of like chasing and hunting that really plays into it. I mean, psychologically, it's fascinating.
I think that watching your work in The Loudest Voice, I mean, you play a woman who's older and different face and everything. And
yeah.
Watching your work in that, watching your work in American Women, it truly are. It almost brings up a question of, do the roles get more interesting when you get past that tumultuous time where you're supposed to be the ingenue or the woman of the moment? Like, is there more interesting work, you think, after that?
When people stop seeing you as a stake.
Yes. Yeah. Like, are you finding that this may be, unlike the fear that besieges probably a lot of actors of, oh, I get past a certain age and I'm not going to be wanted anymore. Have you found the opposite to be true?
Oh, quite. I think I'm playing a long game. I mean, I might not be the biggest, I mean, I'm certainly not. I never really had aspirations of being the biggest movie star in the world, but I think I'm someone that will always work. And the fact that I could play Deb in American Woman and that they cast me as Beth in, you know, that was really gratifying in some way. I mean,
yes.
That's a real.
And we should say that Beth is this really like Washington
Republican,
put together Republican
God squad.
Exactly. Yeah. Extremely different from your character Deb, who's middle of the country, ragged around the edges.
Yes.
And that you're doing both of these at the same time.
That's pretty cool, actually.
It's impressive.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, I think that your own curiosity in the roles you choose definitely connect to why I like your work so much. And I've always been a fan. And,
thank you.
And I appreciate you opening up. And
interviews can sometimes become like therapy sessions, though, because I honestly don't think about, like, why did you choose this role? What went into it? I was like, I just felt like doing it. I swear to God, there's not much more to it.
It was
than
a
that.
Tuesday. Like, I didn't have anything else to do.
I was like, fuck it, sounds fun. You know, like, maybe it is that unconscious. And, like, how did you get into that mindset? It just fucking happened. It's very hard to articulate. So then when someone sits here and asks questions that are quite profound and investigative, then I'm just like, wait a minute, oh. And then I start, you know, this is essentially like a shrink's couch for me that's being filmed.
Well, at least you didn't have to pay.
Oh, right, exactly.
Yeah.
God, it's expensive.
There's a good point to that, which is that when you look at a career, when you look at your choices over time, there is going to be a through line that does describe your personality.
In retrospect, it's going
to
look
good. In retrospect, but it's true. It's hard to talk in the moment about why we do anything,
because
who knows?
Yeah.
But I think that you've managed to put together this incredibly diverse career. You've played these iconic women. You've done a range that anyone would love to have that career in. And I feel like there's so much more coming. So
hopefully. Thank you.
Thanks for talking to me.
Thanks.
Hey folks, that's our show. If you want more Sienna Miller, you can see her in American Woman and also in Showtime's new series, The Loudest Voice. Also, if you haven't seen it, I would recommend going back and seeing Factory Girl and then check out The Girl and Interview. One of the great things about my job is I get to dive deep into the film careers of all these iconic people that come on the show. And I had an especially good time going deeper into Sienna Miller's filmography. So do yourself a favor and check out some of her work that's less widely known. And you'll find out what I already know, which is that she is a talented and versatile actress. And, you know, Off Camera is a talented and versatile show. In fact, we're not just a podcast. We're also a television show and a magazine. First off, I'm glad you've tuned into the podcast. And if you haven't subscribed yet, take a minute and go to iTunes, subscribe, and you'll never miss another episode being downloaded right to your phone. While you're there, leave us a rating and review, because that helps other people find our show. Then at offcamera.com, you can check out all the other things we do. On television, we appear on DirecTV's Audience Network every Monday and Wednesday nights. And if you don't have DirecTV, you can also find us in our television subscription package, which you can subscribe to right on our website. For just $4.99 a month, you have access to every episode we've ever done. That's almost 200 episodes, and you can watch them as many times as you like on the device of your choosing. It's a great way to dive deep into the off-camera experience and see what you've been hearing. So check all that out. You can also find us on social media. We are Off Camera Show at Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And I am Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. And if you check out my Instagram, you'll see a lot of behind-the-scenes photos from this show. So that's kind of a cool thing and a good way to keep up with which guest is upcoming. I want to thank everybody that works on this show. Crawford Shippey, Nathan Shields, Michaela Galvin, Sasha Snow, Kara Johnson. All these folks work really hard to bring you the show each week, and it's not easy. We're a small crew, and we love what we're doing, and I'm just really grateful to be surrounded by talented people. And thank you. Thank you for tuning in each week, giving me the opportunity and an audience to send this show out to. The little kid in me would be just over the moon that I get to make a little show in my studio in Santa Monica, and it goes out all over the world. And it's been a great joy for me to do this show, and I hope I get to do it for a long time. So thank you for being a part of it. And be sure to join me next week when I sit down with actor and podcaster David Tennant.
On the press night of Romeo and Juliet at the Royal Shakespeare Company, my brain started doing that thing, well, you don't know how this speech ends, you don't know how this speech ends. And I just sort of made a bit up.
Really?
And I'm thinking, I'm making up Romeo, Shakespeare, the Royal Shakespeare Company, to an audience of critics who've seen this play 150 times over their careers. But I knew what the sense was, I just couldn't quite figure out what the words were. And I just sort of...
You improvised Shakespeare.
I did a little bit. But you know what? Nobody noticed.
You're kidding me.
Nobody noticed.
Surely the most humble actor ever to play both Richard II and Hamlet for the Royal Shakespeare Company. David got his start at age 5 in the backyard, fantasizing he was the lead character in the popular and long-running British television series Doctor Who. He would wear his replica multicolored scarf knitted by his grandmother and imagine he was time-traveling through worlds. This fantasy and role play led to a life of wanting to be an actor, and 25 years later, David found himself playing the actual Doctor Who on British television. His overnight fame from that role did little to diminish the wonder of actually getting to do what he loves for a living. In fact, if he stops to think about it too much, he gets what he calls the heebie-jeebies. But that didn't stop him from creating a fantastic podcast where he talks to actors about fame, nerves, and the strange lives of thespians. So in other words, we had a lot to talk about. See you next time, off camera.